We are back with the Paula Gordon Show. We are delighted that Alan Dershowitz is our guest. Bill Russell is saying he wants to talk, but I get to talk first this time, Bill. When you're talking about stories, many of the stories that you tell in your newest book, The Genesis of Justice, are stories out of your own experience mm-hmm. as a lawyer.
Right.
I was quite taken by the notion that Genesis itself is talking about a time in the human experience that is before a legal system, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when one can only rely on violence and guile, in mm-hmm. your words.
To me, the explanation of why Jacob is so revered. Here's Jacob, a man who cheats everybody. I mean, Jacob cheats his brother out of his birthright. Then he cheats his blind father. Then he cheats his brother again out of the blessing. He's a man of guile and conniving.
And God really likes
him. God likes him. Why does God like him? Because he didn't kill his brother. In every other story of fratriarchal dispute, one kills the other. In a country without law, you can't go to the law courts. So you have two choices, violence and guile. Guile is an admired trait, but it has consequences. Jacob, at the end of his life, says to the Pharaoh, I have lived a terrible life. All the days of my life have been full of deceit. You know, he who lives by deceit dies by deceit. And he was tricked, you know. His sons trick him into thinking that Joseph has been killed by a wild beast. It's a life of deceit. So there's a lot of symmetry there, but you can't understand why guile is admired, either in this book or, for example, in the Odyssey. Odysseus is a man of guile and much admired for it. Leaders are supposed to be people of guile if they can avoid bloodshed by having guile, or even if they can turn bloodshed to their advantage.
You're talking about a time in human development as you talk about this, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Isn't one of the things that I, whether I'm right or wrong, found quite charming about thinking along with you as you wrote a book for me, was to look at this as part of the human experience, mm-hmm. as people mature, as culture matures, as we individually and collectively move from everybody's guilty to one person must be responsible, when you move from violence is the answer to, well, mm-hmm. we're going to have some rules and we're going to enforce them and there will be consequences.
It's a metaphor for human civilization, for the progress of civilization. It starts with rules without reason. Don't obtain wisdom. If you do, I'll kill you.
Thou shalt not, period.
Right. But yeah, without any explanation. Then it moves toward human experience, toward common law, ultimately toward codification, the Ten Commandments. I think every one of the Ten Commandments can be traced to a story in the book of Genesis. And the Ten Commandments, many theologians will tell you, came, you know, from Sinai, out of the blue, as God's command. Well, look, you trace it back.
Fully formed, one time only.
Right.
Yeah, that's a different story.
Right. 500 years before the Ten Commandments, we had various codes that are just like the Ten Commandments. The big difference is they weren't based on the experiences of human beings. And that's the democracy at work. We see what the experiences are, and we create laws based on our experiences. We see, for example, how do you ever justify needing two witnesses before you can punish somebody? Well, we see what happened to Joseph when all you needed was one witness. He's falsely accused of attempted seduction by Potiphar's wife. He then plants evidence against his brother. They're falsely accused. If you have two witnesses, it's much harder to plant evidence. It's much harder to falsely convict anybody. You know, you ask about the prohibition on being disrespectful to parents. The book of Genesis is all about disrespect for parents. All about it. And you
over
need a rule
and over and
over again.
Again.
You get children disrespecting their parents and parents disrespecting their children. The intergenerational disputes are great. And finally, we need some rules. Are they enforceable? Of course not. Nobody can make you respect your parents. But at least we know it's the right thing to try to do.
And there will be consequences if you don't.
Right.
You mentioned, I think, Hillel is a contemporary of Jesus's. And I think there is, I think I've got the name right, a modern-day Hillel that characterizes all of the Bible at Midrash. And then that essentially the Midrash is a variation on a variation, but that these are really just stories, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. his view, that these are stories that try to make sense of where we were, where we came from, who we are, how we get along, and how we can live together.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. This one rabbi says he thinks the Torah itself, the Bible itself, is a midrash.
Is that disrespectful of the Bible?
I don't think so. I think it's not. I think it has a higher level of value, and it's written in much more beautiful terms. But I think it's absolutely true that one can look at the Bible itself as a midrash about how the law came to be. The Catholic Church says that. The Bible is a metaphor. You don't take the Bible today as science. You don't take it as history. You don't take it as cosmology. You take it as a metaphor, divinely inspired.
This is coming across your book at this time to me was very interesting. We've done a good bit of work recently with primatologists who are beginning to look at our close relatives, other primates, and look at the social relationships between and among them. And some will say that they can see the origins of ethics, the origins of morality, and the behavior necessary for particularly primate groups to get along. It looks the stories that you tell and the representation can almost be mapped. And mm-hmm. in a sense, from looking at it from an anthropological, from a primatologist standpoint, it's almost as if for a long time we didn't have science. Mm-hmm. What we had was language and the ability to manipulate language and the need, apparently, very real need, to try to make sense of the world we inhabited. Mm-hmm. And so we created these stories. And the stories that are created, the ones particularly you describe in Genesis, can be mapped, I think, without a great deal of trouble, not only forward into current law, but sideways in, or even backwards into our primate ancestors.
I agree. And one of the great disputes that primatologists now have today is whether any animals understand mortality, whether any animals understand death. Some people think that elephants understand death. Some people think that some high-level primates understand death. Others disagree, and they say we're imposing our mindset on what is otherwise instinctive behavior. The first story in the Bible is about mortality. When you eat from the tree of knowledge, you learn something. You learn you're mortal. Kafka said, the meaning of life is that we die. The Buddhists say, death is life's great gift. Because when you know you're mortal, you have to resolve moral issues within your lifetime. Everybody, when you go to a funeral, tragically, of a young person, every minister, rabbi, and priest will tell you the same thing. Live life as if you're going to die tomorrow, because you never know when it's going to be over. Mortality, in some respects, is a great gift. Knowledge of mortality, at least, is a great gift. Do animals have it? We don't know the answer to that question. And it may be the one defining difference between human beings and other primates.
So what do we do when it isn't true and they've got it too?
Well, and, you know, what do we do? I've asked my very religious friends, what would ever happen if we were to discover life, sentient life on other planets? So would it really throw religion for a loop, particularly if they were partial human, partial not human? The Neanderthal man, if they had survived, and there was a period of time when they might have survived, might have been something very, very close to human beings, but without conscience and without ability to think in a way that could create religion.
There are those who maintain that humans were juxtaposed against not against Neanderthals, but a whole range of other primates. There were, mm-hmm. were comparable species. We won, they didn't.
Well, and the book of Genesis has a story which I talk about, and that is the Noah story starts with when the giants roamed the earth and impregnated the daughters of man. This may be a primitive memory of a time when human beings were not alone on the earth as an elevated species. My biology friends say no, that never happened as far as they can tell. But recent data about Neanderthal man suggests conceivably the possibility that something like that may have occurred. You know, the Greek mythology is all about gods and humans and demigods and partial gods and a tremendous amount of procreation, of course, in Greek mythology. You notice what we call Greek religion, we call it mythology. Our own religions, we call them religion. One wonders
why
whether,
is that? Is whether, this part know, of who won?
Well, it's not tendentious, I don't think. It's not prejudicial.
But you wonder 1,000 years from now whether or not some of the religions that we now regard as sacred will be called mythology. It's not beyond the realm of possibility.
Well, thinking about that, apparently there's evidence that Neanderthals and humans coexisted for much longer than had been the mm-hmm. case. There was also, I don't know if it's been disproven, but a few years back there was the talk about the barrier that had been at Gibraltar at one point that kept the Atlantic Ocean out of what had been a wonderful valley. And then at some point, the seas came over that, and wonder one, everything in every direction was flooded.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because what you describe in Genesis is a very inchoate state. It is a pre-rational almost state. It's as if the word the ideas are there, but they're still struggling with wrapping the words around the ideas and tying those together and trying to make sense of it.
I think that's exactly right. One sees an empirical world of natural law beginning to evolve. We don't know its law. We don't know what to call it. It's not systematic. There's trial and error. Status is elevated to a much higher degree than we would like to see it. We see mistakes. And then ultimately, we see what forms into a common law, you know, a series of accepted rules. They're not written down anywhere, but they're accepted. And eventually, you get the great revelation at Sinai, where we find first 10 commandments. By the way, if you count them, they're actually 12, but we call them the 10 commandments.
And then first language, then math.
Right. 613 other rules that follow on the 10 commandments that are expected to be observed.
I want to go back to this Midrashic part.
Mm-hmm.
I find it fascinating that you have made your life's work the law.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are returning to the tradition that you grew up in, which was very much one of learning what the Torah says,
mm-hmm.
and finding ways to dispute and find your own answers within that. It isn't by accident that you go looking for justice and the roots of justice in Genesis.
Oh, no, not at all. And it's not an accident that I became a lawyer. I mean, and it's not an accident that so many Jews are lawyers and so many people who come from the yeshiva tradition, which I come from, became lawyers.
The yeshiva being the
Jewish parochial school,
yeah.
Right. The Jewish parochial school, like the Jesuit parochial school, is argumentation all the time. You're constantly trying to prove your point. You're constantly trying to defend the indefensible, and eventually many of us become lawyers, philosophers, teachers, and then we go back to our roots. When you turn 60, you need roots, and the roots are deep. And it's not an accident either that at age 60 I started working on this book. It was in me. I had to write it. I knew that I had been talking about these issues, thinking about them, teaching about them, arguing about them. The time had come for me to write my own midrash on the book of Genesis.
And he did. His name is Alan Dershowitz. He's going to be with us when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. We hope that you are too.